What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another fun episode of Between the Tackles. I'm Burge. I'm here again with Manish. Manish, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I'm especially doing great since we've got Samir Suleiman on the show today. Samir is a former vice president in the league who worked for nearly three decades in the NFL league office and for teams' front offices like the Jacksonville Jaguars, St. Louis Rams at the time, Pittsburgh Steelers, and most recently the Carolina Panthers. Samir's got an incredible depth and breadth of knowledge on not only the business side of football, but the X's and O's as well, given his diverse background, which includes negotiating high-profile contracts, navigating the ever-changing salary cap, and engaging on the pro scouting side as well. So really happy to dive in with him today, get some of his expertise and anecdotes through the years. Welcome, Samir. Great to have you on, bud.
Thanks for having me on, guys. It's an honor to be here.
Well, look, before we do a deep dive into the dynamics of free agency and the impending free agent week about to hit us, I do want to talk about two high-profile Pro Bowl players under contract who are seemingly at an impasse with their current teams, and that's Raiders pass rusher Max Crosby and Eagles wide receiver A.J. Brown. We'll start with Crosby, Samir. I'm sure you've been on your fair share of teams with disgruntled star players. If you were Tom Brady, Clint Kubiak, and the Las Vegas Raiders brass, would you be amenable to trading Crosby? And if so, what kind of price tag is realistic?
It's a difficult situation that they're in, right? Because the name of the game is you want to accumulate as many great players, and Max Crosby is a game wrecker as you can on your team to help you win. So, you know, I think at this point, and we don't know that what's going on behind the scenes. You know, I guess I read that he was disgruntled about being shut down from his injury last season. But I mean, at this point in the offseason, you know, where if they haven't had a chance to get through to him, especially with the new coach, you want to do what's best for the organization, but you also want to be careful about the precedent you set, because, you know, there's been situations before where, you know, if you're just any disgruntled player, if he's just going to go say, well, trade me, get me out of here. And then you're going to have, you know, that come up every year, which you want to limit that. But, you know, especially in his situation where he's already been paid a lot of money. So if they were to trade him, they would accumulate a huge amount of dead money. So that needs to be factored into the compensation that they seek. But he's easily, and this is based on trades I've seen and offers for similar players or even less of his talent. I mean, he's easily worth at least two number one picks. But I would even say higher than that, because of the dead money that's going into it. But, you know, I had similar situations. You know, obviously the most obvious one was in Pittsburgh with Antonio Brown, which really broke my heart because I respected the heck out of him for being, I mean, he was the hardest working player I've ever been around. But he made it clear to us that he did not want to be a Steeler again. And so we made the decision to move on from him. And you know, looking back now, obviously we made the right decision. There was another situation with another team where a player that we had paid, you know, not as much as Max, but we had paid him a significant extension. He became disgruntled and asked for a trade. Well, the problem was there wasn't significant trade value for him. So he still kind of wouldn't let up. He was kind of acting up almost every day in practice. I called him into my office. I gave him an exact number, which was a little over $10 million. And I said, you know what? If you want to pay this back to us, we would be happy to grant you release. And needless to say, he happily declined that and said he was happy that he wanted to remain there. So it's funny how those things kind of work out when you press them on money issues.
Yeah. You know, speaking of mercurial wide receivers, when it comes to A.J. Brown, I think the worst kept secret in Philadelphia and maybe around the NFL is that he isn't particularly happy with the quarterback play of Jalen Hurts. How would you handle this situation if you were Howie Roseman? Is it smart business to trade a difference-making player who's clearly still in the prime of his career?
It's not, you know, like I said before, you don't want to get rid of good players, but at the same time, you also don't want to have them around that they're going to sour your culture and become a locker room lawyers. And we saw that all publicly, you know, transfold last year where it seemed like he was an issue or at least a talking point every single week of their season. So again, at this point in time, if they haven't cleared the air, and he still wants out, I think you have to do, you know, what's best for your culture. I'm not saying, and Howie would never do this, but I'm not saying you give them away, obviously, and they're not going to, but you definitely set your expectations for compensation. If teams don't meet it, then you sit the player down and say, you know what? We think you're worth this. Nobody else in the league does. So that's the situation it is. You know, you're here until you're not. He has a contract to uphold.
It's funny. I mean, there's, you know, the word on the street, and, you know, take the word on the street for what it's worth. But the word on the street is that that Howie Roseman and the Eagles are looking for something similar to what the Jets got for Quinn and Williams when they got a two this year and a one in 2027 from Dallas. Do you think that's a comparable package for A.J. Brown?
I think so. I mean, he's definitely worth, obviously, at least a first round pick. And, you know, I personally hate to give up those high picks, but when you look around the league, I mean, I don't think they would get two first round picks. And I say that based on history. When you look at the receivers that have been traded for two number one picks, I don't think it panned out for the teams that accumulated them. And I'm sure, again, Howie's aware of that history. So, you know, I'm sure he's probably asking for at least two ones, but he'd probably be happy to get a one and a two for him.
Yeah. I think a fascinating subplot for the A.J. Brown story is it seems that if he were to get traded, that he would ultimately land with the New England Patriots. You know, the Patriots this week informed Stephon Diggs that he will be released, so there is a vacuum there at that position. And Mike Vrabel, you know, was explicit at the scouting combine last week that he actually still texts with A.J. Brown, his former player with the Tennessee Titans, about things, you know, ostensibly outside of football, just kind of life relationships. And Mike Vrabel's known for having those type of connections with people. You know, as someone who has worked with teams for, you know, nearly three decades, do you think that constitutes tampering? Because on the surface, it seems explicit that that's tampering, but I just wanted to get your thoughts, you know, based on, you know, being in front offices for all these years.
You know, there's a difference between tampering and tinkering, and I'm sure Mike would claim he was just tinkering, but you know, it's definitely a valid point that I think the Eagles could probably you know, call the league and file a grievance and ask for an investigation into it. And then you have, you know, maybe Mike's phone gets you know, they asked to see his phone and text messages between the two. So I definitely wouldn't be advertising that, you know, he was talking to another team's player.
Yeah, I think the last time the NFL tried to get the cell phone from a Patriots employee, that employee who shall remain nameless, who we actually mentioned a couple minutes ago, destroyed his phone. But maybe that's a different conversation for a different time.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's funny because Manish brings this up because I am a diehard New England Patriots fan. I'm from New England, so he loves throwing the digs in at my New England Patriots whenever he has the opportunity. And that's why he's like he's calling for Mike Vrabel to be investigated for tampering out here on the podcast. But I want to move along to free agency. Obviously, that's coming up here in the league just next week. And, you know, as a fan, you know, I only see what the insiders report. I'm not, you know, behind the scenes or anything like that. So I wanted to get your opinion on what, like, the biggest misconception about free agency that maybe the everyday fan doesn't understand.
I think it's just, and probably because in this era of fantasy football and the Madden video game and the website, Salary Cap website, wannabe experts, is that it's easy to sign players. You know, there's 32 teams, and if there's a top player, the majority, you know, probably at least half of those teams are going to try to sign him. So even if you make the highest offer he receives, he still might not want to go there. You might not like your coach. He might not like your city. And there's a lot of just other factors behind the scenes of, you know, maybe the GM and head coach want to sign a player. Maybe they have that need, but maybe the owner doesn't want to sign off on the check. Because what it ultimately comes down to with free agency, it's not whether the player can play. He wouldn't have lasted to hit free agency if he couldn't play. It's whether he, number one, he fits your system, he fits your culture in the locker room, and whether you can afford him.
Yeah, that's interesting because obviously, like, I play a lot of Madden, so I go and I just sign the I submit the highest paid offer to just get whoever the heck I want. But yeah, it's certainly an interesting perspective to hear that, because, you know, as a fan, I'm sitting there on free agent or the quote unquote legal tampering day one, glued to my TV and my phone, looking to see who these guys sign. So it's definitely an interesting thing to hear that.
How spirited, you know, before you can target players, you need to know how much money you're going to spend, Samir. So can you take us through the process of setting a budget? Obviously, everything flows from ownership, but how are those discussions and that budget created? I mean, do you just get a blanket number? It's X million dollars that we can spend? Or is there a dialogue? Is there a back and forth, a room for negotiation, if you will, within the organization before determining how much money you're going to have at your disposal?
Yeah, and so, you know, everybody talks about the salary cap, and obviously the salary cap is set by the league and every team has to adhere to it. But every team, coming from the owner and what I call their wallet watchdogs, you know, in the form of the CFOs, they set a cash budget. You know, some owners don't mind if they spend over the salary cap, you know, in the forms of signing bonus, things like that. I worked for owners that at one time, one owner wanted me to spend less than the cap. One owner wanted me to spend up to the cap, which in my opinion creates a competitive advantage for that team. Because I think when I did a study a few years ago, the average team spent about $10 million over the cap. So, but yeah, basically what happens is we have these budget meetings where I sit down with the owner, maybe the president, the CFO, and it's kind of, we go over the plan we have for free agency, some positions we want to address. And then it's, I don't know if you remember the old Oliver Twist movie with the orphan, where he says, you know, can I have some more porridge? Or that's kind of how I felt in these budget meetings, when they're kind of, you know, looking at me after I'd given them the number that we want to spend in free agency. So, and it's very fluid, obviously, because if you don't get the targets you set, then you kind of go to the next guy who's going to be a little bit cheaper. And then you have room for that to maybe go get another position to fill that you didn't think you were going to have before. So it's very, very fluid. And, you know, everything kind of happens so fast once that negotiating period starts.
I'm glad you mentioned the study that you did recently, where you said what the average team spent about $10 million over the cap. I think that the typical fan doesn't quite understand what that means, because you hear fans and you see fans on social media saying, well, my team's got $80 million of salary cap space. I should get, you know, any number of players that I want and that they want. But within NFL circles, there's a concept called cash over cap, which I don't believe a typical fan quite understands what the difference is between spending cash and what the salary cap is. Now you've been in the NFL, you've been in the NFL for, you know, 30 some or 20 some odd years, almost 30 years. When you came aboard, I'm imagining the cap was in the $50 million range. Now it's over $3 million. How does that impact
million,
cash
yeah.
spending? And just, you know, if you can just take us through a elementary tutorial on what cash over cap means, and, you know, how prevalent is that in today's NFL now?
Yeah, so I think the salary cap this year was set at, I think it was, what, 301.5, something around there. It was over $300 million. And so that's what you can spend in cap. And the salary cap, even though it's a hard salary cap system as opposed to the other pro leagues like NBA, where it's soft, you can still manipulate it in different ways through giving signing bonuses that obviously you spread it over the length of the contract so that big signing bonus doesn't hit in any particular year. But the way that cash comes into play is, and the way you can kind of manipulate your cash budget is with deferrals. You know, I think I'm one of the last few negotiators that still defers money, because teams just don't care anymore like they did when I first started. But for me, it was necessary so that I came under our cash budget. Whereas, you know, let's just say give a player a $2 million signing bonus. You say, okay, we're going to give you $1 million when you sign, and then we're going to give you $1 million after the next fiscal year. Well, that $1 million will count towards the following year's cash budget, not the current year. And so that's kind of how you can kind of get around that, you know, on both ends of the system and the budgets.
In this day and age of the NFL, are there teams, and even if you go back, you know, a few years when you did your study, were there teams that traditionally spent under the cap that didn't even reach that threshold?
Yeah, I think just coming to mind, I think Cincinnati, because now you have under the CBA, the new CBA is the there's like a 3 year window that you have in spending to meet that threshold. And just coming to mind without looking at anything is Cincinnati is usually very close to not meeting that threshold. Probably not so in recent years after re-signing Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins, things like that. But yeah, there's always a couple teams that it's like they don't spend, and then that third year they're big spenders just to try to hit it.
It's fascinating, and I'm sure you're fully aware of this, but this week news came out that Stephen Ross will be selling 1% of the Miami Dolphins, whose valuation is now at $12.5 billion. So he's going to get $125 million for selling 1% of the Miami Dolphins, which is just
We
incredible.
should pull our money together.
Yeah, I mean, if it was 125, you can count me in for, 50 or so. But isn't it amazing when you think back to when you entered the league out of school? I think you worked for the management council right out of school. But then when you started working for teams, what was, if you remember, what was the actual salary cap back in the late 90s?
Man, I'd have to look back. I think it was, I mean, it was definitely less than, I want to say it was around 50 million, but I could be wrong. I'm guessing. I'd have to go back and look.
It's amazing just
Incredible.
how the growth has just exploded. And you always hear about how greedy players are. I'm going on a little tangent here, but you hear about how players are greedy, and then you hear this week that owners were suing the Players Association for attorney fees for a grievance that the two sides had recently. Do you anticipate a time where the growth will slow and the salary cap, will flatten out at some point? Or are we headed toward, at some point in the next decade or so, a $500 million salary cap?
I mean, as long as the TV networks keep paying these huge contracts and the league keeps finding these different revenue streams with streaming services and going expanding the global market, sky's the limit. I mean, it's almost economy proof. So far, knock on wood, and that's what Commissioner Goodell has been great at during his tenure. I mean, he set that. I remember years ago when he set that goal of 20 billion in revenue. I think people were like, kind of took people by surprise, and I think last year there was 23 billion in revenue.
Yeah, it's
Incredible.
remarkable. Before we dive into specific players in this free agency class, I kind of want to circle back for a moment what you said about the fluidity of free agency, because that's one thing, in my experience covering the league, talking to front office executives, just how fast and unexpected things can get, and how hectic things can get. If you're not prepared, and perhaps more importantly, if you're not prepared to pivot quickly, you can kind of get swallowed up in the entire experience. Can you kind of walk us through what that was like for you? Maybe your top target, maybe your team's top two or three targets were off the board, or maybe the agent was, stonewalling in some respects, and you just had to make a decision that we got to change directions here, or we're gonna, be left behind. What is that dynamic like in real time during those first few days of free agency?
When we set our free agent board stack, it's kind of you have the top of the market players, and you have adequate starters, and then you kind of have sufficient backup players. And I kind of made a point, at least in my role, was every single player that we might have an interest in, I made sure I had a conversation or had a meeting with that agent, just because I know how things work with. You're not always going to get who you want, no matter how much money you offer them. So you have to keep your options open. And so, during these meetings, and in these conversations, I'm just obviously taking notes, but just you have a good feel just based on the relationships I've had all these years with all the agents of, and I was always upfront with them. If I got a number, I said, just tell me what your number is. And a lot of them are very reluctant to give numbers, but the ones that know me and I've done a lot of business with, they give me a number, and I tell them right then and there on the spot, hey, we're in or we're out. If we're in, I say, let's continue the conversation. If we're out, I say, let me know if something changes. Because sometimes they throw out a ridiculous number, and then free agency starts, and the market's not there for them. And then lo and behold, they're trying to reach your call when you're on the next guy that you're ready to sign and, trying to get things in. That's happened a couple of times. So, but yeah, you have your targets, and obviously we want to work our way from the top of the list down. But there were times where I'm having a conversation and the agent's just, shooting for the stars, which again, that's his job. I totally get that. But I knew I was literally wasting time because during that negotiating period, every phone call you're on with one agent, you're missing out on another player at another position. So, yeah, there were kinds of, it's just kind of a gut feeling or a feel for the flow of what's the negotiation is that, you know what? We're not going to get this guy. We're wasting our time. He's not ready to do deal. Let's go. And I always entered negotiations. I mean, in general, with always, a starting point and a walkaway point. And then with free agency, I kind of added an element to that with, well, I got a backup plan in mind. If this guy can't get this guy, we're going to this guy. And so there were several times with several teams where we didn't get the top guy at the position we wanted, but the second best guy we got ended up working out better for us. He ended up being cheaper, better value, better teammate. So, it just goes to show you never know how things are going to work out.
Who was the shrewdest agent that you have dealt with through the years?
Shrewdest. I'll tell you what, my favorite agent to deal with, because he is a pure deal maker, is Drew Rosenhaus. I would do a deal with Drew Rosenhaus any day. And we've actually done deals for first round picks at three different, when I was with three different teams. So, we have a great relationship. I respect him. I think it's mutual respect, and he doesn't screw around. A lot of agents like to screw around with language issues or, BS incentives that they want thrown in. And Drew really doesn't screw around. And that's what I like about him.
Yeah, I mean, he's a deal maker. Everyone around the league knows that he's a high volume producer when it comes to being an agent. It's funny, you talked about having a starting point and a walkaway point. How often did the head coaches intervene if they really wanted to pound the table for a particular free agent? I say this because there's one example that jumps out to me when I was covering the New York Jets. They were in 2018 on Jerick McKinnon, who was a dual threat running back for the Minnesota Vikings. The 49ers, however, were also in. And Kyle Shanahan, as you know, has a penchant for falling in love with players, not only in the draft, but in free agency as well. And if he wants a player, he's going to get that player. And I remember the Jets thinking that they were pretty close to landing Jerick McKinnon. They were running the West Coast offense, very similar to what Kyle runs in San Francisco. But Kyle just kept going to Parag Marady, who was the contract negotiator for the 49ers, and saying, we got to get this guy. And they kept upping the bid, and it surpassed their budget for Jerick McKinnon. Now, it didn't work out because McKinnon had injury issues. But this is an example of a head coach really kind of saying, hey, look, I know you guys are smarter than I am, and you budget a certain amount for particular players and positions, but I got to get this guy. Did you ever have a situation like that where you had to kind of stretch your budget or even break the budget because the head coach wanted a guy so badly?
Yeah, and that happens, in free agency. It's rare that you're gonna get a deal with you're happy with, because more times than not, you're overspending. But, we try to meet with the coaches and work out and collaborate so that we're all on the same page about, where we rank the guys and what we can afford. It's kind of funny because when we first give the list, obviously the pro scouts spend all season accumulating this list of players we're tracking and who we think are going to be good fits and who we can afford. We give the list, to the coaches to kind of go through, and they come back, and it's like every staff I've ever worked with, the top 10 free agents just so happen to be, they're all Pro Bowlers. They're all going to be franchise tag. They're all going to be top of the market. And then it's like, okay, guys, calm down, And so part of my role was presenting options to them, and saying, look, I know you want this guy. If we can't get him, I can get you this guy and that guy. And they're like, oh, okay, we can have two guys for the price of one. Okay. And it's kind of, walking them through the process. But yeah, to my recollection, I never had somebody as a coach, a head coach, as strong-willed that, it was more so wanting to re-sign our own players before we hit the market. I know when I was with the Rams, and obviously we had a lot of success going to Super Bowls and greatest show on turf. And so I know it was important to Coach Martz that he wanted to keep as many players intact as we could. And, the problem with successful Super Bowl teams is they get rated the most. So, a lot of times it was like our, our third or fourth receiver that he was crucial to us, but he's getting offered and paid, you know, starter money. And we just had to make the difficult decision to move on and address a different area with that money.
Yeah, I'm sure it's, you know, not great pushing back against these, you know, type A personalities who, you know, head coaches are typically, they know who they want. And but it's good that you've worked with, you know, more flexible guys. You'd mentioned Mike Martz. Mike Martz had a, you know, reputation of being a very passionate, you know, passionate. I'm not telling you something that you don't already know, very passionate person in terms of being really opinionated on different people, which is, you know, why he was successful, obviously. Let's pivot to this free agency class, some of the more coveted free agents, just some of the, you know, I don't want to say red flags necessarily, but maybe some of the caveats of the guys who have been being discussed a lot. And I obviously want to start at the quarterback position. I think it's a relatively weak quarterback class. Malik Willis seems to be at the top of that class, you know, given that he has acquitted himself well in relief of Jordan Love a handful of times over the last couple years. How do you even begin, if you're a team that's interested in him, how do you even begin to formulate what his value is, just given that, you know, he had been a backup in Tennessee, didn't work out, and has only had a few opportunities to show what he could do, and he's done well, but it's been an extremely limited sample size.
It is a scary situation. And, you know, when I started reading recently that, you know, his agent's putting out there that he's going to get at least 20 to 30 million for him, the first player, comparable player I thought of was Matt Flynn. You know, if you remember Matt Flynn, mm-hmm. He played the season finale for the Packers, had what, maybe threw 400 yards. And then the Seattle Seahawks gave him a huge free agent contract, you know, right before they drafted Russell Wilson. And that's kind of what I see in Malik Willis. You know, he did some good things in college. He came out in a weak quarterback class, and then, you know, he was on a losing team with a bad quarterback situation, and he couldn't emerge as a starter. So I think career-wise, he's 3-3 as a starter. You know, he obviously played well in that one start in relief last season, but I would be scared to death to offer. Mm-hmm. And it's nothing against Malik. I'm just calling it like it is, looking at his production at this level. I would be scared to death to give a player with that small sample size $20 million.
Yeah, I agree. There was also an unusual development at the quarterback position in the last several days. Daniel Jones getting the transition tag. You typically don't see the transition tag regardless of the position, especially at the quarterback position. Playing at an extremely high level for about the first half of the season in Indianapolis, but then suffers an injury, so you don't really know, you know, what he's going to be coming back. What do you make of Chris Ballard's decision to give him the transition tag?
Well, I've been a part of teams that I've used the transition tag three times, both in Jacksonville, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh. The transition tag, the reason teams don't use it more often is because if you don't match, if that player gets an offer from another team and you don't match it, you don't get any draft compensation for him. But I understand Chris's decision, because if you don't think that player is worth the franchise tag, which is significantly higher than the transition tag, then you're kind of overpricing yourself, because then the agents are going to say, well, if you think he's a franchise player, then we want even more than the franchise tag. So I understand, you know, the use there, and they're basically saying, if you think you're worth more than that, then go get it. And if we think you're worth what the contract another team wants to offer, then we'll match it. If not, you know, so good riddance.
I want to end the quarterback part of the conversation with a free agent, just, you know, newly minted free agent, Kyler Murray. I think everybody knew that the Cardinals were going to move off of him. But there's conversations about the New York Jets perhaps being interested in Kyler Murray. And I ask you this specifically because Frank Reich, as you know, is back in the NFL, offensive coordinator for the Jets. You worked with Frank when he was the head coach in Carolina. You have a good understanding of what he values in quarterbacks. Do you think that Kyler Murray would be a good fit for Frank Reich in New York?
I don't want to speak for Frank, but I personally do not. And I don't know Kyler Murray as a person, but obviously he has played at a high level in this league. Obviously he's multiple Pro Bowls. But if everybody does remember when he signed that big extension, there were internal questions about his work ethic for preparation at the position, so much so that they actually made a point to raise that issue in a contract, which had been unprecedented. So, you know, they're going to have to do their homework and see if he's improved or not. You know, you have to question whether a losing team that's willing to part ways with him with no compensation for him. You know, I question that. I question, you know, what's the reason? And yeah, I mean, I know it's hard, and every, you know, Jets fans are probably like, come on, can we finally get a franchise quarterback? But and again, you know, it's so hard to find one, and you really have to explore all options and turn over every stone. But yeah, I personally don't see a good fit there, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, well, the Jets had a franchise quarterback. They let him go, and he hoisted the Lombardi Trophy a few weeks ago. Again,
we had him too in Carolina. Yeah, we had Sam too.
He was in Carolina too, but you didn't draft him with the number three pick. Big difference. Regarding Frank, what is Frank Reich looking for in a quarterback? I want to bring up Bryce Young. You know, he's clearly improved over the last year or so, but where did Frank Reich stand with Bryce Young when you guys were deliberating, essentially Bryce Young, C.J. Stroud, and just generally speaking, what is Frank Reich looking for at that position?
I mean, he's looking for a leader on the field, obviously, you know, because, and Jet fans might not remember this about Frank, but he's the king of comebacks, both at the collegiate and the NFL level. You know, he holds the record for largest comebacks in at both levels. And so I think Frank, he was just looking for somebody, you know, somebody, especially in referring to Bryce, he's looking for somebody that's a leader, somebody that can make all the throws, that's mobile. And Bryce, you know, that was coming out in that quarterback class, like he stood out. You know, there were questions obviously about his diminutive size. And me personally, just being a former receiver, I always wanted my quarterbacks to be statuesque and have a big arm. But where Bryce kind of separated himself from Stroud and the other quarterbacks in that class, where his testing and his interviews, I mean, he had a decent pro day, don't get me wrong. He had a good pro day, made all the throws. But where he stood out was his intangibles, where, you know, it was almost like very, I jokingly say he was almost like Eddie Haskell, where, you know, he just tells these, you know, captivating stories at the dinner. And, you know, his testing was phenomenal, whereas opposed to some of the other quarterbacks were not very good. And yeah, it was a unanimous decision in the building. And I know after his first 2 years when he wasn't playing well, I guess there were whispers that, oh, so-and-so didn't want to take him. And that's a bunch of BS, because if that was the case, then, you know, that person didn't speak up to any of us decision makers when we made that choice.
Yeah, look, I fully respect the Leave It to Beaver reference. I think that Burge is a little bit too young to get that reference.
Well, I know about Eddie Haskell.
Oh, okay.
My parents called me Eddie Haskell.
I love the references, don't get me wrong. I mean, Samir and I could have a million Seinfeld references, including a personal Seinfeld story that we'll leave for another time. But I do appreciate that. But yeah, you know, I was always curious about, you know, the Panthers and the Bryce Young versus C.J. Stroud decision. And I'm very curious how much impact Frank Reich will have ultimately in who the next quarterback for the Jets will be.
Yeah, I'm sure he's going to be heavily involved in it. You know, if I'm not mistaken, the last time he was a coordinator was with the Eagles when they won the Super Bowl. So, and I think it's a good hire for the Jets, because anytime a rookie head coach can add a former head coach, let alone a two-time former head coach like Frank, just as a sounding board on that staff, that's tremendously helpful to him, you know, when things aren't going wrong and he can bounce different ideas off him and situations that Frank's been in before. But Frank was a pleasure to work with. I mean, he's one of the easiest head coaches I've ever had the pleasure to work with.
Yeah, I love Frank. And, great. Yeah. I mean, I think genuinely nice human being. That's what stands out when someone ever asks me about Frank Reich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I want to move on to the defensive side of the ball in free agency. That's where I want to go with this. There's a big name out there, is Trey Hendrickson. Now, I don't know what the Cincinnati Bengals are doing with him. He had that contract standoff a little bit ago, and he was not tagged this offseason, so he's going to be right out there for the highest bidder or wherever he wants to go. Do you think he's going to be like a top dollar type free agent this year? He is older, so there is some concern there, but do you think a team is going to reach out and try to really, really pay him top dollar on this market?
Probably knowing his agent, probably not as high as his agent thinks. You know, I think you absolutely have to take into consideration. He's, I believe he's 31. He's coming off a core injury surgery, if I'm not mistaken. And those are two significant factors to consider, you know, when you're handing over a lot of money. You know, after the age of 30, I mean, not just at most positions, but especially pass rushers, you know, there's not many, you know, thinking over the years. Obviously, Strahan was good well into his 30s, Reggie White, you know, I'm going back real deep, but, you know, it's you're kind of having to go off of the 2024 tape, which again, that's guessing, but everybody needs a pass rusher. So I'm sure there's going to be several suitors that are in the market for him.
Now, do you think that the Cincinnati Bengals kind of mishandled him as a player? Because I know there were talks when he was having that contract standoff that there was a chance that he was going to get traded, you know, before he got injured, even this past year.
No, if I'm not mistaken, before 2025, he had, you know, they gave him a contract extension, and I think once or twice after that, they tweaked his contract. You know, he wasn't happy with it, and they tweaked it a little to try to appease him, which that's more than, you know, and I'm not second guessing, and that's more than I would have been willing to do in a lot of teams, because again, you have to consider the precedent that they're setting. You know, you don't want to be giving players, your best players, raises every year just because they're not happy with it. But it, again, it's a difficult situation, and, you know, they were probably under pressure to try to get something for him while they could. And I'm guessing that their rationale is, well, we'll get a compensatory pick for him, you know, if he signs a big free agency deal this year, because they were so obviously trying to compete, you know, for the playoffs last year.
Yeah, I think they would have been right there had Joe Burrow not got hurt last mm-hmm. year. I think they would have mm-hmm. been right there. You know, as a Patriots fan, like, my team needs a pass rusher, and myself, I want the Patriots to steer clear of that, because I think he's just going to be an overpay and a mess waiting to happen. But moving on to some more of these free agents, there's some more of these big names out there, the running backs. The Super Bowl MVP was not tagged. Kenneth Walker was not tagged by Seattle. Looks like he's going to be going on. And Jaguars running back Travis Etienne, who had a really nice year under first-year head coach Liam Cohn. With the running back position, it seems over the last probably decade or so that position has been really kind of devalued in the league, where, you know, like me personally, I want to have a good running back. You know, the dual threat running back is really, really key to a lot of these offenses. Now, would you dole out big money to get the Super Bowl MVP or a guy like Travis Etienne in there? Or do you take more of the approach where going into, say, the draft to find the next guy where you can get him a little bit more cost controlled is the better approach?
I've actually seen it work both ways, and I don't know if this is good or not, but I think in my career, I've made three running backs the highest paid running backs in the position at the time. It was, you know, Marshall Faulk, Steven Jackson, and Christian McCaffrey. So I always value that position, and when you have a good one, you don't want to let them go. You know, at the same time, you know, I'm in favor of, as I like to say, tag him and bag him, like the Jets did with Breeze Hall, and what we did with Le'Veon Bell. You know, the Jets' favorite running free agent running back that, you know, we tagged him twice in Pittsburgh, because again, running backs, just over history, right? You know, because of the wear and tear and the number of carries, that the decline is coming. So you have to be real careful about the ones that you give that second contract to, which in free agency, I mean the way Kenneth Walker played in the Super Bowl in the playoffs, I have no doubt he's got a lot of juice left in him. So it'll be interesting to see what his market is. But yeah, to answer your question, there are a lot of running backs that I think you can, and again, history shows the number of great running backs that you can get in the later rounds. It really just depends on your system, your running back coach, how well you think you can get a just plug and play a player into your system.
Now, you mentioned Breece Hall. He got tagged. Do you think the Jets are going to look to re-sign him? He was very unhappy last year when all his buddies got dealt out of New York for good reason, I might add. Do you see that? Do you see them just bagging him? Like you said, bag, you know, what was it? Tag and bag was
tag him out, tag him and bag him.
Yeah. So do you see him moving on and them actually making a trade?
It depends. I don't know what his, you know, he obviously had a good year last year, not great. You know, I think it was the first time he was over 1,000 yards. So, you know, and I think the reason they probably tagged him is because he's one of their better players, but they couldn't agree on his market value. So the tag, you know, kind of raises market value. So it'll be a little hard to get him for less than what they're tagging him for. And so maybe they just play out the year, see how he does again, see if he's productive again, and then pick back, you know, talks up after the, either during or after the season, and if not, let him go.
Yeah, I think that there was actually a misstep there. And correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, maybe I'm just not seeing it through, Samir, but the Chiefs reportedly offered a fourth round pick in the 2026 draft for Breece Hall. I guess they could tag him twice, but what? Let's just say, for argument's sake, they tag him. They can't come to a long-term agreement, and then he walks after the 2026 season. Would that have been a missed opportunity? Should they have, in that scenario, should they have taken the Chiefs' fourth-round pick offer before the deadline last year?
It's hard to look back and second guess on decisions like that. You know, like I said, he was one of their better players last year. And when you have a new head coach, you're trying to accumulate as many good players, not you know, give them away and trade them away. But I mean, a fourth round pick for his production was probably a fair offer. You know, they were probably looking for a little bit more than that, and that's why they didn't pull the trigger.
Yeah, they probably wanted a third round pick. I think anything other than that would be unrealistic for you know, some of the reasons that you outlined. He just had his first 1,000 yard season. He has had injury concerns, and they weren't shy trading away Sauce Gardner, which I think anybody would have done for two first round picks. But Quinton Williams also, who's still a highly productive player, they got a great return. But I think there was a clear movement from the outside looking in, a clear movement to kind of bag the 2025 season and accumulate as many assets from a draft pick compensation perspective as possible. So I was a little surprised that they didn't move off of running back. But I do want to go to another skill position, and that's wide receiver. You know, George Pickens, if he hit the open market, would have been the most coveted player. But I don't think he's going to go anywhere. I think ultimately he'll sign a deal with the Cowboys. There's another player who just kind of jumps out in much the way that Malik Willis jumped out at the quarterback position. I look at Indianapolis Colts wide receiver Alec Pierce, who had his best season as a pro last year, you know, barely cracked 1,000 yards, and I believe in 15 games. You know, quality player. I think a complementary, supplementary type of player. But this is a guy who's, when you look at the wide receiver market in free agency, is probably going to get, I can't believe I'm saying this, but he's probably going to get 20-plus, maybe $25-plus million. And I don't understand this concept of a good player making just incredible money. I know it's supply and demand, and you've been through the rigors through the years, but it seems like even more so now, these slightly above middling players are getting paid as if they're top five talents at their position.
Yeah, the issue is, you know, obviously as the salary cap increases and there's more money for teams to spend, there's a larger margin of error because then they can just cover up their mistakes. So you see every year, every free agency period, probably at least a handful of players get overpaid. And lo and behold, they can't live up to that billing. And then they're on the market again in a year or two. And the teams just never learn from that. And then they're from their mistakes. And again, because the salary cap's so high, they can just cover them up. And then there's no accountability usually from the owner or of the person that did that horrible deal for the franchise.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of Alec Pierce as a player? You know, without getting into market value and things of that nature, am I wrong in thinking that he's, you know, he's a complimentary wide receiver? He's not a number one on an NFL team.
No, like you said, he's a good player. He had a good productive season, but just again, in my opinion, when I think of $20 million a year player, I'm thinking of a game changer, and I don't think that's him.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at tackles, I think it's even thinner. The Green Bay Packers left tackle Rashid Walker, who I believe was a seventh round pick, he's certainly late in day three pick. He's probably going to get paid a lot, and frankly, I don't even think he's good. Like, I don't even think he's league average. I think he's slightly below league average. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, I'm not a scout, but just based off of what I've seen, the middling is probably a compliment when describing him, and he's probably going to get paid a lot because there's a dearth of left tackles, and especially a guy who's in his, what, I think he's in his mid-20s, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's not as if he's on the wrong side of 30. he's going to get paid a lot too. It's fascinating to me that, and I think you hit the nail on the head, because the cap has grown so much, there's a lot more room for error. And when there's a lot more room for error, there's a lot of opportunity to be more reckless than, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Right, because, you know, when I probably the first, decade or so that I was in the league, if you made a mistake on a $5 million a year player, let alone, 10, 15, 20, like that's going to hit your, that amount of dead money is going to hit your cap and really handicap you. And now you see multiple teams that are just absorbing these, 10, 15, $20 million dead money hits from former players that didn't pan out. And it's, it's just, oh, business as usual. Let's move on. There's like no repercussions, no learning from their mistakes or anything like that. It's the same cycle year in, year out.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Hey, look, when you're a booming business like that, I guess you can do that. And I think that's a natural transition for me to ask you a question about college athletics, NIL, college athletic departments, as you're fully aware, have really gone through a radical shift here. And if you look at former NFL general managers and front office executives, they're occupying the college sports space, whether it's an NFL GM, there's high profile guys like Mike Lombardi working with Bill Belichick at UNC and others. What do you think the next 5 years will look like for college football programs, given the reality of NIL?
Selfishly, I wish NIL was around when I played at JMU about 14 pounds ago, because I would have loved to have cashed in on some of these deals. No, I think it's just the issue is the overall irresponsibility of colleges that have been, they've been steamrolled by agents of coaches for years when they give them these ridiculous contracts, and now they're being steamrolled again by agents into handing out money to kids that just for sake of keeping up with the Joneses, because the people that they're entrusting this money with and to deal with the agents have no idea what they're doing. But they all think they're wheelers and dealers, and the transfer portal is another mess. In my opinion, players should be allowed to transfer only one time in their career. But and then when you factor in, they really need to do something about the kids being allowed to play for too long. Like, I think there's a Montana player that he was just granted a ninth year, which is, I hope he has a medical degree when he gets out of there, because that's pretty, like, come on, kid, like, get on with the real world, get on with your life. 9 years is, that's pretty ridiculous to me.
It's like Van Wilder.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that, you know what? I had never heard that. Like, this is a Division I player?
Yeah, University of Montana. I think it's a linebacker. I forgot his name, but it was. I read it a couple weeks ago.
That's actually a great story. Bert, do you have anything else on the football front? I want to ask a non-football related question before we get out of here.
No, just real quick. You brought up the dead cap hits and how these teams are able to absorb these massive cap hits. You're seeing it. It feels like to me you're seeing it much more, especially in the last 5 years, and you're seeing it with the quarterbacks, with guys like Russell Wilson was a massive hit for the Broncos when they let him go. Kyler Murray, I mean, you may see it happen with Tua Tagovailoa. Like, how are these teams able to work around these handicaps? I get the cap is high, but I mean, if you're absorbing almost a third of your cap with this dead hit, how do you work through that?
Well, there's kind of one of the ways to manipulate the cap, and within the CBA is that you designate them the post June 1 designation, so that kind of spreads your cap out, your dead money hit, over 2 years as opposed to just one. So that, I mean, that helps. But yeah, I mean, you're basically, I think the GMs are presenting this to their owners as, oh, it's the cost of doing business. Like, we need a franchise quarterback, but we were wrong, so we got to move on from it. It's incredible to me that there's so little accountability in these bad decisions of the contracts that are given out to these supposed franchise quarterbacks, which I think, when you look at, without naming names, you can look at them and say, they weren't worth that to begin with. I could have told you they weren't going to live up to that contract. What were you thinking? Especially the teams that are in a rush, after the player's third year to hand them an extension because they played well for one season. It's like, come on, guys, like, what happened to the days, Kurt Warner had to become both the regular season and Super Bowl MVP. And we still, I think we did the first non-guaranteed option for him because we just wanted to make sure he wasn't a one-year wonder, which of course he wasn't. But we still did a deal like that, which was fair to him, and it protected the club in case he wasn't. And you just don't see that anymore. Nobody cares anymore.
Yeah, it's like it's the new age. It's the new, like you said, cost of doing business. To me, it's just wild. Like I when these guys are up for their extensions, and you hear they're going to be the highest paid quarterback in the league, and what have they proven? They haven't proven anything yet.
Yeah, the lack of logic in some of these extensions, it drives me crazy, because if you have a player that nobody in your building, let alone across the league, thinks is the best player at his position, why the hell would you even consider making him the highest paid player at the position? What do you think is, how do you think that's going to turn out?
Well, now you're seeing the precedent set across the entire league, where now it's like, well, the next guy's up for his contract. You know what he's asking for, regardless of what he's proven.
It's there's no more merit to these negotiations about, okay, well, is he better than this guy? No, it's who's next in line, whose contract is up next, and let's just make him the highest paid. And it makes no sense, and it rarely works out for the club.
It's just wild to me, and it doesn't seem like there's an end in sight to it. So yeah,
no, it doesn't, because there's owners are making so much money that they just don't care, and so there's a lack of accountability within the general managers and the people that are handing out these contracts.
That's just wild to me.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I don't.
Go ahead, Manish, take it away.
I think it's going to reverse course. This next in line blueprint, I think, is going to be the way it's going to be, especially at the quarterback position. It's so silly. It's like, it's all timing. It's not really about, like as you said, Samir, it's not really about merit. It's not a meritocracy when it obviously, well, I think it obviously should be. We'll get you out on this. It's one of my favorite stories about you. It's got nothing to do with football, salary cap, playing football, watching football, evaluating football. It's about hunting. And, Virg, I don't know about you. I have never hunted. I'm not a hunter.
We can change that.
What? I don't know about that. I'm not sure we're going to go with that. Samir is a lifelong hunter, avid hunter. I believe learned from his father.
Yes.
There's a great human interest story I would love for you to share. About one of your recent trips to Africa, I guess Mozambique. I'll let you have the floor and take it away.
Yeah, this happened back in 2015. It was a bucket list hunt for me. I always wanted to go to Africa, and so I went to Mozambique and had a decently sized list of things I wanted to accomplish. But what ended up being really the thrill of the entire hunt and the proudest moment of my career as a hunter was when I got there. My guide told me that there was a local village boy that had been killed by a hippo. And that particular year, hippos were, they didn't have it. I think the quota was low, so they weren't granting hunters to hunt hippos. But because this hippo was designated a problem animal by the local government, they asked my outfitter if when I came in, because you have to have permits and everything, and they know what the hunters that are coming in, if I wanted to help the villagers. And I said, and they said, you can help them out. You can't export a single piece of the hippo with me. So I said, that's fine. Absolutely. Let's do it. And so I spent 2 days hunting this hippo over the water hole. These villagers, they share these watering holes with, killer hippos and crocodiles, and they have no weapons to defend themselves. Even if they did, it'd be illegal for them to, just because of the way the local government works and the villagers work with them to economize hunting so that everybody benefits from it. But anyway, long story short, we're sitting there after the second day, towards the end of the day, and all of a sudden I hear this. I mean, it was like a monster-like sound, and the water birds are flying everywhere, and you see the head of the hippo emerge from the water. And then he quickly got back down, and I was like, oh man, I hope that wasn't the only time I see him. And so about an hour later, he gets back up again, and I hear my guide whisper in my ear, shoot him between the eyes. And so I made a perfect shot, probably a little under 200 yards, and you just see him sink below the water, and you see like a tidal wave. And so we said, I felt pretty good about the shot, and they have so much gas in their bodies, it could take hours for them to float back up to the surface. So my guide said, let's come back tomorrow to get them. So we go back the next morning, and as we're approaching the village, the entire village is standing at the water hole, and they're cheering, and you can see the hippo, he's in the water. And so about six guys just jump in this snake and crocodile infested water and grab the hippo and pull him to shore. They immediately just started butchering right then and there. And so we lined up every single villager and they give me a big chunk of meat and I turn to give it to the villagers until literally every single piece of the hippo was gone. And then the mother of the boy, she was very appreciative of me. I mean, she had me in tears just because, you know, just to be able to give a grieving mother, you know, some solace, you know, very proud of that moment. So, you know, that's something that'll live with me, you know, the rest of my life.
That's awesome.
It's such a powerful story and yeah, a story I think most of us will never experience. But yeah, I wanted you to share it because I remember when I heard the story about that, I was really taken aback. I, you know, had my wife listen to the story, which was on a hunting podcast. I just thought, you know, it was just a very moving, just a moving story that I know that you won't ever forget. And speaking of things that you won't ever forget, you know, we spent the better part of an hour talking about football players, contracts, and now hunting. I did bury the lead. Samir is about to be a first-time father, and as someone, as you know, who has just become a father, Burge has three boys himself. I want to say in the next several days, we are welcome to the club.
Thank you. My wife and I, Aaron, you know, we're very anxious and anxious awaiting our baby girl any day now. And I've kept my phone on just to make sure that she didn't text that her water was breaking while we're filming this. So it looks like we made it through at least for another night.
Congratulations. It's the best thing ever.
Thank you.
It's the best thing ever.
I'm excited and terrified at the same time.
And then you're feeling it right. You're feeling it right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Between the Tackles podcast. Be sure to follow us on social media, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, at Tackles Pod, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. This episode will be up there along with the entire catalog. Be sure to like, subscribe, and download. We will catch you next time.